Welcome to Let's Talk Learning Disabilities with Lori Peterson and Abby Weinstein. Lori and Abby spend their days talking about dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and ADHD. They talk to parents of struggling students and adults who have had a lifetime of academic challenges. They want to share those stories along with their own insights with you. So, let's talk learning disabilities.
Everybody, this is Lori.
And this is Abby.
Welcome to episode 62 of Let's Talk Learning Disabilities.
We are so happy you guys have joined us today during our intervention series. We've had some special guests talking about various interventions related to different types of learning disabilities. And today it's a little bit more general. We have a special guest, Patrick Mullick, is with us today, and he's going to be talking more about behavioral de-escalation strategies and helping our students learn more independent life skills and strategies for being independent and successful in their academic careers. So, Patrick, thank you for joining us. We're so happy you're here.
I am absolutely thrilled to be here. It is an honor.
Good. Well, thank you. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Well, you know, it's okay. Most people get it wrong. So it's actually, if you want a visual for it, think of the animal mule, right?
Oh.
And then like, ick, that's disgusting. And then that's my last name, Mulick. So
Mulick.
I have no idea what my ancestors did to get that name, but that's what I have.
It's just not very phonetic.
It is not phonetic, which
know,
most names
are
not. Okay, well, good. Then thank you, Patrick Mulick. We are so happy you're here. So, Patrick, to start us off, tell us a little bit about you and how you landed where you are today.
Yeah, so I originally grew up in Oregon and went to school at Gonzaga University, and I've always had a heart for kids, and I got into my first class about supporting students in special education, and I was in hook, line, and sinker. I quickly realized that this is the field for me.
Aww.
To be able to work and support those who weren't given a fair lot in life.
Mm-hmm.
I immediately was just all in on it. So
he's one of us.
Yeah.
Well, and it's funny. Some of the most passionate people you find in the field of special education or the field of disabilities is parents who have a person with a disability, or the adult themselves might have a form of a disability. Because of that, they're advocating. But it's funny. It's those individuals who oftentimes have the least amount of time, right, to support and do the good work. And I'm a typically developing individual, and all of my kids are typically developing, and which means I have a little bit more time, right? And so I want to commit my time and my passion to doing that good work and supporting those with disabilities and making a difference for those who, again, were not given a fair lot in life. So
Aww.
So I went to Gonzaga. I ended up coming to the west side of the state in Washington State and ended up teaching preschool. There's not a lot of guy preschool teachers out there.
Definitely not.
I absolutely loved it. I love the little ones. They are just a joy to support and to be around. But I started out as a preschool teacher. I got talked into teaching at a middle school behavioral program and ultimately taught high school self-contained for about 5 years before I went on to becoming a BCBA and then a district administrator. So as I sit here today, I am the Assistant Director of Autism and Student Independence in the Auburn School District in Washington State.
Wow, that's great. That is so fascinating. And it's very similar to Lori and I's backstories because we started out as special educators as well. And I did want to clarify for our listeners that Patrick said he is a BCBA, which stands for Board Certified Behavior Analyst. And how would you explain that in layman's terms for our listeners? What exactly is a board certified behavior analyst? It sounds very fancy and like you analyze everyone you come in contact with.
I've been analyzing your behavior since we started.
Oh, bless you.
Oh, no.
No. No. So yeah, we love our acronyms in special education. So there's another one, BCBA, Board Certified Behavior Analyst. They're an individual that is well-versed in the field of applied behavior analysis. And actually, to become a BCBA, you have to have your master's, right, in behavior analysis and do a great deal of field work in making sure that you have a clear understanding of what ABA is supposed to look like, whether it be in the home or in the classroom in a variety of settings. And then you have to sit for this like impossible exam and get certified and maintain that certification. So essentially, it's someone who has a special training, special mindset on applying the concepts of ABA into the real world and making sure that it's representing the field in the way it's intended to.
Okay. Cool. Thank you. Yeah. So you have a really strong understanding of behavior and probably have a wealth of information as far as behavioral interventions. And, you know, here with what we do and what we talk about, various learning disabilities, behavior seems to be kind of across the board. It affects all students, you know, or not all, but it can affect any student, regardless of what type of disability you might have. You might have a learning disability in written expression, but still have some behavioral challenges. It's not only, you know, individuals with autism spectrum disorders or ADHD. So I love that you have this broad knowledge of behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you speak. Do you speak primarily to school districts and educators, or do you work with parents also?
So a little bit of both. There's a variety of audiences that I get out that I speak to. Oddly enough, the group I speak to the most, it's not the group that you think of. I speak the most to actually school bus drivers.
And really?
I've presented at a number of national conferences and state conferences around the country to school bus drivers around these very concepts, supporting individuals with disabilities, supporting behavior in a positive way. Because you think about the school day itself, school doesn't start for a student when the first bell rings. School starts the moment they step on our commercial vehicles that are driving around town.
Yeah. True.
And it's the school bus driver that rings in the opening and closing ceremony for a student's day.
Yeah.
And so we want to make sure we get it going in the right way and then it closes in the right way. And those school bus drivers, they're educators just as much as everyone else is. And so I'm out there providing that instruction, that coaching, that support for those large masses who are really the bookends for our students' mm-hmm. day.
Okay, very cool.
So we were just talking about how great that is because, you know, students who have spent all day feeling frustrated, feeling, you know, confined, they've dealt with their either academic struggles, behavior struggles, social struggles. They get on the bus and you've got that unstructured time now. And I would think that's really when a lot of behaviors escalate.
Absolutely. That unstructured time, we forget that there's a lost skill that our students don't necessarily have that maybe previous generations did. What do you do when there's nothing to do, when that right. structure isn't there, right? We live in an age where most of us are used to instant gratification with mm-hmm. a screen in front of us. And that's something that's a bit of a lost skill of what do you do when there's no structure in the day? And you think about that at a time when someone has exhausted all of their mental energy for the day.
Right.
They've given everything they got into the social pieces, the academic pieces. And then it's typically on a school bus where, yeah, there's one adult and then a whole bunch of kids and the adult isn't even facing the student. So how do you manage that in an appropriate way? That there's a lot less that a school bus driver can do just based on the circumstance, but there's still things that you can do to help to provide that welcoming environment, that structure, that accountability on the bus.
Well, yeah. And as the adult has a job to do, like they're focused on being safe, mm-hmm. you know, so they're not only are they not facing the kids, but their focus is somewhere else. And so that adds just another layer of challenge to that whole scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then the child gets off the school bus and they're relieved to be at home. All this overstimulation from the school bus goes away, and they go home, and their mom or dad may ask them, now sit down and do all this work. Right?
We really need to think about a student's day in the big picture of everything they go through. So often as educators, we have that vision of what it's supposed to look like from the time we receive them to the time they leave us. And parents have that perspective of what it looks like when they receive them. We really need to look at a student's eyes through their lens, what they experience the moment they wake up, the thinking about what's coming up, the anxiety of the school day, still being groggy in the morning, getting your breakfast, getting on this vehicle that's still warming up, that's crowded with a bunch of kids, and then showing up at a school where very high demands are placed. You're asked to do things that you've never done in your entire life. And then to stay a high performer the whole day and to be your best self, we know as adults, you can't be 100% 100% of the time.
Right.
And we have to have our own time to have our own breaks and to step aside and to take a breath. And we need to remember that kids need that too. They need the opportunity to manage and to have times when they're not at their best, because that's mm-hmm. part of life.
Right. So when you're speaking to these groups, are you providing strategies on how to kind of de-escalate situations? Are you doing more awareness of kind of where these kids are coming from and why they struggle? Like, where does your topic usually focus?
All of the above.
Okay.
All of the above. I mean, it is getting that foundation of what behavior is, why it comes about, and the filter we need to have for addressing it. I don't like to give out a lot of very specific scenarios of any time a student starts verbally, I would say verbally aggressing towards another student, or anytime that they're getting out of their seat, or anytime they're disrupting, or anytime they might be hitting someone, every single time do this.
Right.
Because it's always going to be contextual. So much around behavior is around having the right filter, how to look at the behavior that you're seeing and really thinking, okay, how can I get in front of this next time? How can I prevent this from happening next time? But then also thinking, as I'm working to respond, how do I respond in an appropriate way that's going to better meet the needs of the student and really related to why the behavior is happening in the first place. So, so it's important to have that. Then you give the lens of disability. What does that look like for a student who's experienced trauma? What does that look like for a student who has ADHD or a student who has autism, a student who has Down syndrome? What are some filters, additional filters you would want to have? And then beyond all that, what does it look like when it really starts to get unsafe and a student starts to physically escalate? What do we do in the moments when the students are not at their best, and how do we keep ourselves cool, calm, and collected? And with that, I think it's so important not just to provide people the content of what to do, but why you do it. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, to be that hero for that person with a disability, for a bus of students with disabilities, a class of students with disabilities, it's exhausting. I mean, it's good work. It's hard work and it's heart work. It's the right thing. But at the end of the day, it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. And we see in the field that there is a high burnout rate for special education staff, and people Absolutely. Need to not only feel supported. That's a huge piece. They need to have the right supports in place, but they need to be strongly connected to that. Why am I doing this? Why am I getting up every single day and going the extra mile for this group? And so I always want to make sure that not only am I providing content, but I'm providing the inspiration to keep on helping people do the right thing every single day.
And stay motivated. It's exhausting for parents too. You know, we hear, you know, of course, a classroom teacher usually has, you know, 18 to 20, 25 students to manage. But, you know, we hear a lot of parents that maybe just have two children or three children, and it is mentally and physically exhausting to sometimes manage a child with self-regulation difficulties, behavior difficulties, impulsivity, you know, emotional dysregulation. So I was just wondering, like, what are some ways that you can be, before we talk about some recommended strategies or interventions to be reactive, what are some proactive, like positive behavioral type supports that parents at home could use maybe to start their children off on the right foot in the morning, or those kids that struggle getting ready for school or getting out the door, and then maybe even during homework time in the afternoon, evenings.
Right. So I think it always starts with making sure that you have the right mindset. And this applies to parents and to educators in the schoolhouse as well. You need to remember that if you have a person with a disability that you're working with, when they get up in the morning, they're not instantly thinking, you know what? I really want to make it hard on mom today. Or my teacher, I'm really going to push her buttons. I'm going to get up and pace around so much, it's going to drive her crazy. I can't wait to see how they're going to act.
Right.
We need to have that mindset ourselves, that the person that we're working with, though they may have behaviors that come up, the behaviors are not them. That should not define them. That just represents what they're going through. And when we think about a kid who has challenges, we should not ever have the mindset that this is a bad kid.
Mm-hmm.
We need to think about it as this is a student or a person with a missing skill. But because of that missing skill, these other things are coming about. And as difficult as those behaviors might be on us, they're struggling just the same to find their way in the world. And so we need to be that positive adult, that positive person to help get them there. So, and it's hard because some of our students, right? Some of if you're a parent, some of your own kids, they might be really talented at pressing your buttons. And you have to remember, as much as you can, disconnect the wiring.
That's
we have to disconnect the wiring and respond with skill instead of emotion. And that's so much easier said than done, especially in the home, because the home is the place where you're supposed to be able to relax, to be yourself. And when this is the first thing you face when you wake up, or it might be something you're dealing with in the middle of the night, it's so difficult to be that 100% yourself as the adult providing support to that individual who might need something different. So it's tough, but we have to have that mindset that this is an individual, the child that one may have, this is an individual that needs a different type of help, and it's going to need an abundance of patience as we work with them. So I always think it's so important to start with that right mindset, so we have the right view of how to see what we are looking at in front of us.
Definitely.
Outside of that, though, when we think about behavior, we always want to think about the preventative pieces and what do we need to make sure we have in place so that the behavior doesn't come up. Or in another way of saying it, how do we equip the individual so that they can have that successful morning, that successful evening, that successful trip to a family member's house, or going to church or the grocery store? What do we need to do to help them be successful in that time? Because I'll tell you, the best behavioral intervention you could ever use for a person is to use an intervention that's going to stop a behavior before it happens. So, because otherwise, when it starts to come about, whether it's the individual is running out of the house or out of a building or getting physically aggressive or just having a verbal outburst, you're dealing with it. It's already too late. Then you're responding, right? So we always want to make sure, what are we doing to make sure?
We want to prevent it.
Yeah. What are we doing to prevent it? And so that requires us to ask, you know, a couple big questions. First and foremost, when you think about what we want them to be doing, do they fully understand what we mean by
that's huge.
Mm-hmm. Sit still, be quiet, keep your hands to yourself, stay working, right? So, and because some of those expectations are very contextual. Like if you say, hey, quiet down. Well, quiet down means one thing when you're at the grocery store and one thing when you're in the class and one thing when you're on a bus. And like, quiet is a very subjective expectation. So we can put out expectations, and those that we support, they may be able to tell us right back to us what they should be doing, but their understanding of what that looks like or sounds like or feels like in the moment can be different than what we believe it should be. And so there's not a clear understanding of what the expectation is. And so I think that's always, item number one is making sure we're clearly putting out what we want the expectation to be and making sure that they fully understand on the same level that we understand that expectation. That alone in of itself, if they think they're following the expectation and you're telling them, no, you're doing it wrong, that nagging back and forth, that in of itself can right. lead to some big behavioral outbursts. So mm-hmm. The second piece that goes right along with that, though, is, okay, what we've asked them to do, do they have the skill to follow through with what we're asking?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Because we're talking about an individual with a lagging skill, a lacking skill, and is that impacting their ability to be successful in this space? And that's really difficult because we see this across a number of disabilities. Your ability to have a skill to do something in a moment can vary.
Mm-hmm.
And what they may have been able to do yesterday, they're not able to do today. And to ask someone to do something that they're not able to do and they have a history of behavior already, that's going to bring about behavior. So yeah. we have to be careful about that. It's not just making sure they know what we mean when we put out the expectation. But if we're talking about someone who needs to get up and move every half hour, every 20 minutes, and we're saying, no, you got to sit down for this full hour and push it out, it's not going to go well. And then when kids act up because we ask them to do something that they couldn't do, that's on us as the adults.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we have to be careful about that. And knowing that there's setting events that impact someone's ability to be able to follow through with that. Right. So right. how well did they sleep? Are they feeling okay? Did they get their medication? If they have medication, right? Did they just get in an argument with one of their friends or one of their peers? What's going on? Were they up till 3 a.m. playing video games when they weren't supposed
right.
to? Right. All of those things impact one's ability to have that skill set when they're presented with the moment. So
mm-hmm.
we
are
need
they
to
feeling be, fed and hungry and safe and mm-hmm.
exactly all of those and that's really making sure that they have what they need in order to be successful in that time. And so if they need more movement because they're a little bit sleepy today physically, like let's provide them more movement. If they need extra reminders because they're not able to focus nearly as well today, let's provide them those extra reminders. Or if we need to do that with visuals, let's provide that. But we need to remember that with our students, just because we provide them their needed supports, it doesn't mean they're going to be successful. But if we deny them what they need to be successful, we're guaranteeing their failure.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. So
we have to identify what those needs are and provide them.
That's such a crucial topic is, you know, making sure we know what they need and that they have the skills and that we're providing them those skills and supports to be successful. But I love how you said that we need to make sure they understand those ambiguous terms like quiet down. Like I hear parents often
try harder,
calm down. What does calm down mean? Yeah. Or try harder or focus. I'll hear parents say to a 7-year-old, you need to focus, just focus. Well, that is such an ambiguous term.
And do they even know what it means?
And do they know what focus means? Do they have the ability to be able to do it? You know, or following multi-step directions. I know a lot of parents get frustrated with getting ready for school routines or going to bed routines and their child not following directions or getting distracted and being on the floor 30 minutes later playing with their Legos instead of brushing their teeth and changing into pajamas and whatnot. So I think that's so important for parents and educators to start out with that mindset of, let's make sure they understand these terms. Let's make sure they have the skills and supports. And then where do we go next?
Well, and I want to pause just really quick on that because the calm down piece, that's so important what you just called out there. When someone starts to get upset, that's like the thing we will instinctually say is calm down. Mm-hmm. Just calm down. And I just want to call it out. Never in the history of anyone being really upset has someone come up to them and told them to calm down and they're completely losing it. And someone says, hey, would you just calm down? And then that person thinks and says, oh, wait, yes, calm down.
All right.
Yes, I forgot. Calm down. You're right. silly me. I'll sit down and get back to work.
I'm good now.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no. So that should be like those two words there should be like curse words. We do not say them. It goes back to refocus or just listen. Great. Yes, that's what we need them to do, but they're not doing them. So we need to call out for them the things that they need to do to achieve those things. So if it's that they need to calm down, we don't say calm down. It's that we're saying, take a deep breath, count to five, close your eyes. Like we're coaching them through the steps of how to do that. Mm-hmm. Whether that be calm down or we want them to focus or keep their body still. For those who have those missing skills, it's not just enough to call out what you want them to do. In fact, let's avoid those and let's mm-hmm. call out the steps that need to be taken so that they can get there.
I love that. So teach them discreetly those specific steps in gaining control.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then how do you, you know, with young children, how do you know what skills they are lacking, you know, what they're capable of? You know, if you are a parent or a teacher of a student with behavioral challenges, and you had said, you know, one of the first couple steps is making sure they have the skills to follow through with whatever your expectations are. How do you assess that? How do you determine, does my child have the skills to be able to sit still and do homework for 45 minutes to an hour, or to follow multi-step directions and get ready for school and out the door?
How do you differentiate between not wanting to do it and can't do it?
Right. Yeah. Can't do versus won't do. And what I would encourage people to do is before we put the pressures of high expectations on, before we're asking the student to do something they've never done before, really take the time to engage and, in a sense, play with them to see, okay, if they're really interested in the task, if there's a high interest task that they're doing, how long could they tolerate sitting for? Right. What does it look like when it's at its best? Because especially if we're just talking about a younger learner, if it's just something as simple as doing a puzzle or playing with a favorite toy, but even with that highly preferred item or activity that they can't stand to sit still for more than 20 minutes, they're certainly not going to be able to do it when you start pulling out the academics. So at the very early age, it's using that time of play and high preferred times to see what they're able to tolerate, whether that be the noise, how they're seated, right? The amount of feedback that they're given, how much space they need between themselves and other people. That in those early years, it's just a great time to feel out how their body works, right? How their brain works in coordination with the rest of the world around them. And so that's such a big reason why we need to make sure we have early intervention services. So some of those skills can be, you know, tangled out a little bit to identify how much of it is this a growing skill? How much of this is something that's completely missing or that they have? It's just, we have to set up the environment in a certain way so that they can be successful.
And then, so I have a question. You know, we kind of, like you said at the very beginning, you know, kids don't wake up in the morning with like, my goal today is to push as many buttons and to make you as crazy as I can. Like, that's not their MO. But I think sometimes when behaviors do escalate, and it gets to that point where there's yelling and screaming or physical, you know, altercations taking place, that parents and sometimes teachers even, you know, they yell back, right? Like their behaviors don't help de-escalate what's happening. And so what are some things that when it does get, if you didn't do all the things to help prevent it and the behavior happens, now what, right? Because you're here and yes, woulda, coulda, shoulda, but I'm here. So how do I take this very volatile setting and how do I bring it back down a little bit? What are some things that you would recommend or that you tell individuals, you know, on how to de-escalate?
So I will start that by saying it's always going to be contextual on the individual. Sure. And there's general guidance and I'll give you some of those points, but there's always going to be cases where it's a little bit unique and some of the filters you're going to have, you're going to really turn in a different way based on what you know about that individual.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But certainly when a student is escalated, when a person is escalated, their world that they're experiencing is very different than what you and I are experiencing. It's very confusing. It's very disorienting. It's very overwhelming. And having that loud yelling voice coming in, trying to dictate, calm down, sit down, it's just adding fuel to the fire. So before you do anything else, you need to check yourself, right? Am I able to be cool, calm, and collected? Hmm. Right? Michelle Obama once said that when they go low, you go high. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. In supporting someone who's escalated, it's the other way. When they go high, you come in low. Right? When they're highly escalated, you need to come in low, because if you come in escalated yourself, an escalated adult trying to de-escalate an escalated person is not going to end well. I promise mm-hmm. that will not end
well. Two negatives will not make a positive in this instance.
No, it will not. It will not. So first and foremost, it's the adult getting themselves under control, right? Taking that deep breath. And even if you feel like you're a hot mess on the inside, you still have to present yourself as a cool, calm, and collected person.
Right.
So we'll talk about that. It's limiting our communication. So there's the rule of five, meaning when you're going to talk to an escalated person, use five words or less in every sentence, and every word has five letters or less.
Oh, I like that.
Basically break it down, because the more you speak to that individual, the more it just adds to the confusion of their world, which can just perpetuate the escalation. So simplify what you're saying. Right. And making sure that you're saying it in the right tone, what you want them to do.
Right.
I think all of us were blessed with a natural tone of voice that was somewhere between a drill sergeant and a nun. Some of us our tone is a little bit more firm. Others of us, our tone is naturally just a little bit softer. And you need to find yourself right in the middle when you're speaking with someone who's escalated. If you're too firm, if you're too direct, it's going to continue to escalate them, right? It's going to make them more upset. But if you're too soft, they're going to think what you're saying is optional. So They need to hear that you are supportive and you're there for them, but also that you mean business. And so
like it's a firm but loving voice, maybe?
Yes. Yeah. So it's finding that middle ground and just being direct.
Okay.
Have a seat. Let's get a drink of water. And just keeping it simple and then giving the pause, right? Allowing them that time to process what you're saying. Really, when a person is at the highest point of their escalation, what they need more than anything else is just the time and space to work through what they're going through. And that's hard because we have a schedule to keep. We have things that need to get done. It's not okay that they're climbing up there or throwing things at me.
Mm-hmm.
And when an escalation is at its highest point, oftentimes all we have left is giving time and space, and then that integrated support, you know, every 30 seconds, every minute, trying to verbally redirect them. And some of our students, when they escalate, they get to a point where they can't even hear what we're saying anymore. Like any verbal language is bad. So at that point, you might need to pull out the visuals, or you might need to start modeling for them what you want. Because that communication, it needs to be simplified down in such a greater way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And is that something that you think, Patrick, like parents could, when the child is not escalated and upset and engaging in, you know, maybe inappropriate behavior, is that a time where you could like pre-teach, you know, what sitting still looks like, or like going to a nice, quiet, calm place to calm down or de-escalate? I mean, where, you know, a lot of parents still use timeout. And I think if done correctly in a positive way, it could be effective. But I don't know, right place, right time, if kids know exactly, you know, if you say, you go to timeout and get in the corner and you have 10 minutes and you have no longer can access your Game Boy or your Legos, that's more negative. So where, you know, when they're, you're talking about giving them time and space, is that something that, you know, at home you could have that conversation with your child about, kind of upfront before they're escalated, what they're going to do when they're upset or having a quote unquote tantrum?
So I love that you asked that question, because that's such a key piece that so many of us miss. So if you were to find me in a spot when I was personally escalated, let's imagine like we're out in public and someone's really making fun of my favorite sports team and I'm getting red in the face and they're just talking trash about my favorite sports team, and that you saw I was escalated, and then you came up to me and say, "All right, Patrick, downward dog." Okay. I do not do yoga. I've never done it in my life, and I have no idea how to do it, and I probably don't have the skill set to do that. But certainly, you coming up to me in a moment when I'm not at my best and asking me to do something that I never do, that's not going to go well.
Right.
It's the same thing for our students. We think about these great interventions we want to use when they're escalated, but if they are only asked to use them in a time when they're not at their best, it's not going to go well. One of the steps we often miss is that practicing of what we want them to do when they're escalated. If we take that time when they're not escalated to practice, okay, let's practice that deep breathing. Let's practice going for a walk. Let's practice using that stress ball. If they have enough practice with that, when the time comes, when they're not at their best, saying that, being cued, it's almost like it's a reactive strategy that they don't have to spend a lot of time thinking about because they've done it so many times before. It is almost instinctual because they've heard the cue before, they've done it before. And it's not something that's just isolated to the escalation piece. The other thing with that, though, is that sometimes we have interventions we want to use with students only when they're escalated. And that's their cue for them to see that you see them as someone who's upset, and it causes them to be more upset.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, that is a big piece we need to make sure that we have in place, is that proactively when we talk about supporting those who escalate, we're practicing those interventions we would want to use with them so that it's very familiar. The other thing you touched on, which is one of the areas we misuse quite a bit, is the use of the chair or the corner, right? The timeout space.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great deal of misunderstanding around what the original intention of that, right? So timeout, I think better phrased is time away. Mm-hmm. The intention of that in its roots was to have a time when a student might be engaging in a behavior and that behavior is being reinforced. And it's a behavior we don't want, right? So maybe they're telling inappropriate jokes amongst a group and others are laughing. So them being in that space, that they're being reinforced for that. So we're going to say, nope, time away. You're going to go over here. And the intention is time away from that reinforcement. And so they're just put in a place where it's not punitive. It's just the reinforcement they were getting for acting inappropriately is gone, right? And then we'll give them a time, and then we're going to come back. We're going to reconnect with them about appropriate behavior and have them re-enter the space, right? That's where it started, but now it's turned into, you are not being good. You need to go sit in the corner for an hour. Time out for you. It becomes very punitive.
Yeah.
And it's widely misused.
Right.
And creates a number of challenges. So we need to just be careful with how we're using what we might call timeout. And if you want to use it for punishment, you're being bad, so go to this place, then call it that. But just know there's a difference between the two of using time away, a gentle way to help stop reinforcing inappropriate behavior, versus punishment. You've done this bad thing, so now you're going over here. And if that's the use, that's fine. But we in the field forget to remember that punishment is not the answer for everything. And actually, punishment used exclusively has its consequences. It really impacts the student's ability to reflect positively on themselves. It impacts the relationship between the student and the adult that's supporting them. And used long term, it's just the person learns that they're a bad person, which is the right mindset we want them to have.
Right.
No, it really takes a toll on their self-esteem and their self-worth.
Right.
And there's no positive reinforcement. They're not learning the right behaviors. They clearly know what they're not supposed to do, but no one's helping guide them as to what they would rather see or what would be a better alternative. So
It
definitely, we have found that too, that we have a lot of, you know, and that's such an easy, it's almost instinctual sometime to take things away or to ground them or to, you know, punish. And I think that's something that's definitely something that has to be taught.
I feel like a lot of times I've met with parents recently and I hear a lot of, you know, how can I get them to do what I want them to do? How can I get them to follow my rules, follow my instructions? And it's like, I feel like a lot of times Lori and I both were offering parenting advice or, you know, just good disciplining behavior
strategies,
behavior modification techniques, you know, rather than talking about, you know, great ways to help your child have better reading comprehension or strategies for self-regulation or improving time management. So it is out there still in 2023, very much a big issue in homes across America is that we have parents that are constantly saying, how can I make them do what I want them to do?
There's so much that goes into that. There's layers, and especially when we talk about an individual with a disability, there's so many layers to that. And it's hard because, you know, the parent may have had a very different upbringing where if they just got, you know, the right stink eye long enough from the parent, from their parent, right, that they figured out how to fall in line. And we have to remember that it's not about replicating how you were raised. It's identifying how your child needs to be raised. And they may be living in a very different world.
True. Yeah. And I think there's so many aspects of like what you do, behavior analysis and the field of behavior. I feel like there are so many positive strategies out there and positive interventions and supports. And unfortunately, there's not enough of that research to practice getting out into the hands and minds of parents. Maybe it's getting to educators, thankfully, through people like you as an educational consultant and speaker. But we, you know, I see a lot of families and that are struggling tremendously with managing behavior, and they don't even know basic things about, you know, just positive reinforcement, you know, just giving them praise.
But I think too, just like you were saying, I do think, you know, Patrick, you said, well, that's how they were raised, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just go into parenting. I mean, obviously there's no handbook.
Right.
So you just do what you know. And without, you know, I feel like a lot of the training that we've received as special education teachers through our education background has helped. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of parents just go with what they know. And a lot of what they know from what their parents did wasn't great. I mean, it worked, maybe. But they just, so they don't even know that there's something out there to look for,
right?
You know, that there are better ways.
You're exactly right. There's not a handbook when you become a parent anyway, but then you add on the piece around having an individual with a disability, a child with a disability. And I mean, I went to 5 years of college for this and education beyond that and, you know, certification around being a behavior specialist. And it's still hard. Mm-hmm. It's still hard. I absolutely sympathize with the parents who were trying to do this and pay the bills and keep the house running and take care of the other siblings and do the dishes and all of the things that are involved in being a parent. And I think it's so important for that reason, just in of itself, that we have to wrap around our parents who have students with disabilities.
Absolutely.
Because as common as the disabilities might be, ADHD, autism, what have you, so many of them still feel very alone in their journey because so much of the weight that they have to carry. So, I mean, praise to you guys, what you're doing in helping support families who are out there.
But it's
such a high need, and it's not just a family thing. I think it's a community thing. We have to wrap around and support those families who have individuals with disabilities. So if we do, if we're in the grocery store line and we see in front of us, you know, mom has a child who's completely melting down because they can't have the M&Ms and they're screaming and running up and down. We need to offer help instead of waving our finger and giving the look. Mm-hmm.
Right? It's very true. In the middle of Walmart is a good place to see some of those behavior escalations.
Yep. So meltdown central.
Yeah. I think, so what are there resources for parents you know, like you work for a school district and you are, you speak all over the nation. And most BCBAs or board certified behavior analysts work for a school district. Are there private practices or what are some good resources for parents out there if they wanted to work with a consultant or a coach to learn more about positive behavior supports and interventions?
Yeah, so it's going to vary state to state in terms of the names of specific organizations, but there's a lot that's out there. It's hard because it so often can be just extremely difficult to navigate identifying resources. Mm-hmm. But in terms of getting BCBAs, there are many that do work for agencies that go into homes and provide that in-home support, whether that be directly working with the child or through coaching from a BCBA. And that there's a lot of that can be done in terms of coverage from insurance. So that's definitely out there. The field of applied behavior analysis is growing. I was looking at a graph just a couple of weeks ago around the number of BCBAs in the U.S., how it's grown just astronomically. And wow, there's a lot more that's out there in terms of BCBAs than what has been in previous decades. So that's exciting. We're getting out there on the front lines, not just in schools, but in homes. So I would definitely reach out.
Great.
With local agencies, state to state, and ask, where can I get ABA services? Where can I get the support of a BCBA to help me identify how to best support my individual in the home?
That's awesome.
Okay. Awesome. I think what we will do is in our show notes, we'll link some different resources to access board certified behavior analysts and applied behavior analysis agencies.
Yeah, that's great.
That would be a good idea.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your day today. Obviously, you're very busy. We very much appreciate it. I think the information you shared has been incredibly helpful. And I think we could probably talk about this for another 2 or 3 hours.
I think like we've scratched the surface. I have so many questions more too. I could sit and talk for hours with you, but we do really appreciate your time and sharing your knowledge and expertise with us and with our listeners, Patrick. And what is your website if anybody wanted to access your website or learn more about what you do?
Yeah, my website is just my name. So www.patrickmulick.com. You can look me up on Facebook. I am there and I have a big following there, posting things a couple times a day. Or if you could reach out directly to me, if you wanted that, that is patrickmulick@gmail.com.
Okay. We will put all those in the show notes as well. So we'll put links to your Facebook and to your website as well. So thank you for that.
Thank you. And thank you for everything you do post on social media. I follow you on Facebook and you have the most inspiring, positive quotes and great little tips and tricks and strategies here and there. So I love it. Thank you for what you do for our population of special learners.
It's all for a good cause. It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, thank you guys for listening today. If you have any questions or have some suggestions about future episodes, feel free to email us at letstalklearningdisabilities@gmail.com or Abby.
You can access our podcast website at www.ltldpodcast.com, where you can see all of our episodes listed in chronological order, or you can categorize them and choose by category.
All right. You guys have a great day. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you so much for joining us today. In our show notes, you can find information about today's talk, as well as links to resources and other episodes. If you have questions about today's talk, have ideas for future episodes, or just want to stay connected, you can contact us through Diagnostic Learning Services on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. So, let's keep talking learning disabilities. This podcast is sponsored by eDiagnostic Learning. You can find more information at www.ediagnosticlearning.com.